This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
When you look at Brian Koberger's behavior before and after the murders, there's a reoccurring theme. Nothing happens on a normal schedule. Not in his movements, not in his planning, and apparently not in his sleep. Newly released jail records show he's up at all hours, pacing, moving, disturbing other inmates. It's not a man burning the midnight oil on something productive. It's a man who, by all accounts, never shuts off. When you factor in the image he's cultivated, pale, brooding, almost vampiric, you start to wonder if the night has always been his real comfort zone. Is this just a quirk of an overactive, broken mind, or is it another layer of emulation, a behavioral choice influenced by the killers and characters he's modeled himself after? We've already seen how he borrows from BTK, Bundy, Israel Keyes, fictional personas like Bates Motel character, Norman Bates, Psycho, and American Psycho as well. Could his nocturnal habits be part of that performance? Or are they simply the byproduct of a brain wired or rewired to avoid rest? And then there's the bigger question. What does his pattern mean now that he's in prison? Solitary confinement isn't exactly known for promoting mental health. For some, it's a slow erosion of stability. For others, it's an amplifier for whatever was already there. Does someone like Koberger break down under the isolation, or does he burrow deeper into it himself, feeding the same compulsions that brought him here in the first place? From there, we'll pivot to something else that's been gnawing at investigators and observers alike, a break-in at a sorority house months before the Idaho murders, a man with a knife masked standing over a woman's bed until she fought him off, unsolved. No official tie to Koberger, but eerily similar in both risk and audacity. Let's get into this with retired FBI Special Agent Robin Dreek and former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Let's talk about Koberger's sleeping habits, because you brought that up. You brought up earlier, you know, he doesn't sleep, and that's what we've been hearing in newly released documents about his time in jail. This guy, I didn't know you could be up in jail late at night. I thought they kind of made you go to sleep, but I guess they don't. So he's up, he's disturbing the other inmates because he's moving around, he's doing stuff. I mean, it's you know, you look at Koberger and he's fairly vampiric, which is just his image, the vibe he gives off. What do you make of that? I mean, and is that a common thing amongst killers that of the past? Is he emulating someone? I wonder about that. I haven't really dug into that. I don't know. Of staying up late and whatever the hell he's up to, he's doing it in odd hours. He's not necessarily doing it in daylight, it seems.
I think that just goes to it again, pure conjecture on this one too. I just think his brain is so broken, the chemical imbalances in there, it throws off everything, you know, because sleep is regulated mostly by melatonin and our body's natural rhythm. He doesn't have one probably. And so it throws it all off. Plus, I mean, you can't even imagine what the hell's going on in that brain. You know, the kind of machinations it's going through and running through and scenarios it's running through. Because again, that he fixates on things, as we've seen. He's OCD in a lot of things he does. And so that's probably what's happening in that brain, is it gets wound up and just keeps going, probably around really inane things that aren't going very far or effective at all. Because if you think about it, here's someone that's up all the time studying so much, and he still sucked at what he did.
Yeah. Is prison going to bring, how do you think prison's going to affect Koberger? If he's, because obviously he's only been there for a little while. I know he's been in jail, but this is prison. And he's in solitary confinement right now and will be for the foreseeable future. That can do a number on a lot of people. Look at Richard Allen, the man accused of being the Delphi murder, which obviously we don't agree with. But that threw him for an insanity, made him psychotic. He was suffering psychosis. He was eating his own feces. He was running his head into a wall. And he wasn't even convicted yet, but that's a whole other story. That can mess with you. Do you think this is going to be something that Koberger thrives in, because it's a very bizarre, unhealthy than the norm situation, and most would really hate this? Or is this something where this is going to make him, you know, more deep in some ways in terms of his thinking, because it allows him more time to just focus on his madness? And or is this really going to exacerbate his madness and make it come to light of just how utterly crazy his thinking is if he tries to speak aloud at some point?
Boy, it's hard to say. I only know the effect of isolation on a healthy brain and healthy people, as we've seen with Richard Allen, but also throughout time. You know, the first explorers in the Arctic or anywhere in the world, or even people that get stranded on islands, you know, it shows the effect of us emotionally. That's why they do these great studies all the time of, you know, prolonged space travel. If we ever want to go to Mars, you know, they do a big study in this, because psychologically it takes a special kind of person to be able to handle that. On a broken brain, though, there's so many different kinds of broken brains. I don't know what that would do. I definitely after this, I'm going to take a deeper look at the research. But here's what I don't think will happen. He doesn't have deep thoughts. He doesn't strike me, because he's so hollow. He's so empty. If he is as high on psychopathy as he appears to be, that there's not a lot going on in there. I don't think isolation is going to give him any kind of life epiphany where there's going to be an aha moment. I mean, just look at the other serial killer. Again, he's not a serial killer technically. He's just a mass murderer because he killed four.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at other mass murderers that became serial killers. They haven't had, a lot of them haven't had this profound, life-changing, life-altering, like Malcolm X did when he went to prison, kind of moment where, like, we studied, we became better human beings, we took the opportunity. I don't see that happen with Kolberg at all. I think he's going to either remain completely the same, or it's going to break him further.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens with any of that. And if we do find out that he was connected to any other crimes. There's another one that was brought up. I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. It was a break-in that occurred before he would have actually been in Moscow. I believe, people will correct me on this, but roughly 6 to 9 months before, I don't have the actual date in front of me. It was in Pullman, Washington. It was a sorority house. There was, you've probably read about this already, a man with a knife came in wearing essentially a ski mask type thing and stood in front of a woman's bed with a knife. She kicked him in the stomach. He fled. And that was that. But it was quite a brazen type attack. You're going into a house that's filled with women in the night with a knife, and you're thinking you're somehow going to get away with something. I mean, this wasn't like she's alone in her dorm in a quiet place that nobody's at. It's a house with people. Granted, this was a house with people that he killed, you know, almost everybody in and got away. But that's what was also interesting about it, is it does kind of have some parallels of a lot of guts or just really bad calculations and very poor choices for targeting something like that. But again, quite a bit before he would have officially moved there. We don't have anything that says he was in that area of the country at that point in time.
Right.
But curious nonetheless.
Yeah, it's definitely curious. I'd be curious if whether... Because I think he did this to a large extent, well, to some extent anyway, and that's rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a data point collection rehearsal. I remember there was one time after 9/11 in New York, because I was in New York during 9/11, and I lived just north of the city. I remember I'm at the mall with my family, and this was when my kids are very small, and we're going to go see a movie. And I remember in the movie theater, there was a guy that was walking through the lobby as we're coming out, and this was in the middle of summer.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's hot. They had shorts and t-shirts on, and he's walking out, and he's got a big overcoat, kind of like the guy that just did the double murder homicide where you live, Tony. He's completely in black. He's got a hoodie up. He's got a long black trench coat, and he's carrying something long under his jacket. And I remember I told my family, get out. I went to talk to the manager. The manager said, yeah, I've alerted mall security. I called in. So I'm now tracking this guy through the mall, and he goes into a restaurant across from the movie theater, and he's sitting in the booth by himself, just sitting there like this, black trench overcoat. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm about to watch this guy do a mass hit at the mall here. And so the cops come up, and the cops go in and confront him. And he's actually carrying a rubber It was a rubber M16.
It was a dry run.
He was doing a dry run.
Shit.
So the possibility of someone like Koberger or Koberger himself doing dry runs ahead of time to gain data to find out what the response time is, see what the effect of people is. Because seeing the effect that he has in a house, whether it's Koberger or someone else, looking menacing, how long does it take for someone to do something about it? Would they say something about it? How long does it take for cops to respond to a complaint like that? Mm-hmm. That then gives him data how long he has to escape. And so criminals doing dry runs like that, that's pretty common. Well, I don't know how common it is. It's what they'll do.
And he was checking the police scanner right before he did this. I'm going to guess that wasn't the first time he checked the police scanner. I'm going to guess that he was checking it that night. I don't know what that would have told him about that night, if they were just in the general area or if there was other calls they were focusing on or what. But I'm going to guess he checked it at other times too for other things that he allegedly may have done to see, well, what's the response time here or there? That I found interesting about checking it before the night of the actual crime. What does that tell you?
It would... One of my theories on this one is he was targeting location more than he was targeting people.
Mm-hmm.
I've said that throughout this just because I think this house made it an easier target for him. And in one way you identify that is by how much traffic is coming in and out through law enforcement presence.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of things are happening that you're seeing there. Is it because people are loud, because there's parties and there's a lot of people in and out? That's what he was looking for. If he's looking for venue first and then who's in that venue that I can target. I think it was a perfect storm for him that he did both.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, listening to a scanner is going to tell you, it's going to tell you schedules of law enforcement, when their turnovers, their shifts are, because that's an opportune time to do it too during turnovers. So there's a little bit more chaos. During the nighttime, there's definitely not as much presence. You're also looking at who's on, I mean, Grant, these are things I'm coming up with. Mm-hmm. Who knows what he's coming up with, but you're looking at who's on duty, who's actually has a reputation of being on their game and who's not on their game in the world of law enforcement. Again, there's only 37 sworn officers in Moscow. So it's a small department.
Yeah.
And out of those 37, how many are on patrol? So these cops have reps, they have, you know, an image. So those are all data points he could be collecting and taking in just by having a scanner ahead of time. But again, I might probably given him way too much credit because he did not have the maturity and didn't have the reps of understanding how law enforcement actually worked. And why do we know that?
Mm-hmm.
Because he bagged up his trash and put in his neighbor's trash.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, I got to ask this because I know the audience is still sitting there going, okay, what happened with the guy in the mall? I want to ask you, were you packing? Were you ready to draw if you saw him pull something? And what happened to him?
Yeah, so I actually was behind a pillar. I sent my family out of the mall to safety.
Yeah.
And I was standing behind a pillar thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to shoot someone.
Mm-hmm.
I work counterintelligence. You know, me drawing a gun
sure.
in 22 years. It happened once on a bank robbery call that we did as a group. But I was thinking I was going to have to potentially shoot this guy until the cops showed up because I was watching him and seeing what he's going to do. And if he's going to make a move, I was saying to myself, well, I was going through my deadly force policy.
Mm-hmm.
I was making sure it's going to be a good shoot if I had to, so I could, you know, live through this, defend other people through this. So what happened is cops came in, they interviewed him and they determined that he was not a threat and they sent him on his way because he didn't do anything illegal, but they detained him because he was suspicious and able to actually get enough identifying stuff on him where he went from there. Luckily, I never saw a shooting at the mall after that. Yeah.
But isn't that disturbing? I mean, right after 9/11, the whole, it's see something, say something, prime time in New York.
That was December. I remember that was December of 2001.
And they're just sending this guy on his way?
Law is law. You know, it's an amazing thing. You know, it's amazing. You know, my time in the Bureau was it had moments. And I remember there's many times, like I worked a lot with the CIA and other three-letter agencies. And I remember there's many times when the CIA, we knew someone was doing something horrendous on behalf of a foreign government. And, well, like disclosure of classified information.
Mm-hmm.
Is one of them. We knew someone that was having disclosure of classified or mishandling, I should say, The only thing we had on this person was mishandling a classified, even though we had suspicions it was going to the place it shouldn't go. But at the time, we only had mishandling a classified, which is a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. And I remember we'll have the CIA come in and saying, why don't you just arrest him and throw and put him in jail and throw away the key? I'm like, that's nice, but we have this really cool thing called the Constitution.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the things I couldn't do because I was law enforcement and federal law enforcement were pretty intense.
Yeah.
When I retired, I could do so much more research on a human being than I could when I was in, and when I was like, I could not do open source information searches on an individual unless I had a case open on them. There's a lot of things I couldn't do because I was a federal law enforcement officer upholding the Constitution of the United States, which meant I was under rules and regulations of what I couldn't do regarding a human being, mm-hmm. and the amount of focus I could give on them. Reasonableness, because that's always what courts go by. So it was pretty limiting.
What did that mean, as you know, on the surface, as you know, a citizen, you know, a bystander out here, one would go, why wouldn't you get him? But at the same point, I'm gonna hope that they did start to, like, this guy's on the radar now. Like, yeah, like let him back to wherever he's coming from, and let's see who else he has with him, because that could end up opening up another big cell of something if it was going to be something by letting him free. I'm going to guess that's where it went, more than just let's lock him up for a few days. And
100%. So now what happens? So someone like that becomes a data point, and that data point, you have home record, you have criminal history, you have vehicle history. You have all these different things. You now have a friends and associates that you can now identify if they actually were asked him to take a look at his, back then we had flip phones, we didn't have full cell phones yet. You know, so they could actually ask, you know, in other words, they're detaining him so they can voluntarily ask for certain things. And if he responds and they can get it, becomes a lot of data points. And so those data points then say, are you what network of individuals are you part of? Is this associated with something we already know that's going on? Because we have intel, we have an investigation over here. So you're another leg of that, or you're going to start a whole new one. So it's not just like they let them go, or we let anyone go after someone displays suspicious activity, and it's just a dead deal.
Sure.
No, if we see this in cases, when people let that stuff go, then when something horrendous happens, someone says, all the red flags were there. Why didn't law enforcement do something? Mm-hmm. Since I never heard of anything coming back to this again in a negative way, it meant they used that data in a productive way to shut down whatever it was. Or this guy was just a lone wolf moron out doing something stupid that day, testing law enforcement because he's a pain in the ass.
True.
You know, there's a lot of stupid out there in the world, and he might have just been one of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other. It's not always as deep and dark as we think. Sometimes it's just as deep and dark as someone's bedroom and their dark closet and whatever the hell they're conjuring up. If there's one thing Robbins made clear, it's that patterns don't happen in isolation. Even as simple as staying up all night can be a data point. One more piece in the profile of a man who doesn't operate like the rest of us. In Koberger's case, that lack of rhythm might be chemical, psychological, or performative. But whatever the cause, it creates more time for fixation, more time for obsessive thinking, more time for rehearsal. And rehearsal may be the thread that ties it all together. The sorority break-in, if it was him, feels like a lower-stakes test of a high-risk skill set, an opportunity to measure reactions, clock police response times, and refine his own tactics. Robbins' comparison to dry runs in both criminal and counterintelligence world is chilling in its practicality. Sometimes the point isn't to commit the crime that day, but to collect every possible data point for when you do. That mindset dovetails with the police scanner activity we know he engaged in before the murders. If you're willing to listen in, track routes, and learn who's on duty, and when you're thinking like someone who sees law enforcement as just another variable to manage for all this sloppiness in certain areas, that level of preoccupation with timing and venue shows an ambition that outpaces his actual skill. Maybe that's the most important takeaway. Koberger may not be the criminal mastermind some initially feared, but he's also not just a guy who snapped one night. Between late nights, the possible rehearsals, the scanner monitoring, and the meticulous, if imperfect, attention to certain details. Then there's an arc here, one that likely started long before November 13th, and one that, if fully mapped, might still connect to other incidents we haven't yet linked him to. The reality is that with four life sentences, there's little incentive for law enforcement to spend the kind of resources it would take to chase down every loose thread. Which means that if the dry runs, if they were, the scanner logs or the nocturnal pacing point to something more, it may be up to researchers, journalists, and yes, the true crime community to keep pushing for answers. Because if the past is any indicator, Brian Koberger isn't done living in his own head. The question is whether at some point he decides to start talking and what we'll learn if he does. Tell me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you will find us there. Same search can be done on any podcast platform so you can take us with you on the go. Let me know your thoughts, though, in that comment section. Very curious about all of that. Robin brought up a lot of really interesting points. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.